arguments. There's nothing that says this has to be done fast. If you want to pause the debate at any point, to repeat a passage, or to give yourself some time to think, go right ahead. High school and college debate teams use a format named after the Lincoln-Douglas debates. An initial statement by side A is followed by a brief questioning by side B. B's full initial statement is then followed by a brief questioning by A. Each side is then given a chance for rebuttal with an interesting structure: a short rebuttal for A, a longer rebuttal for B, and a short final word for A. I know, it's complicated, and our debate won't follow that strict form. In fact, the Lincoln-Douglas debates did neither, although they did allow equal time for each side in an ABA structure. Douglas spoke first in four of the debates. Lincoln spoke first in three. And now for our great debate. As you listen, I want you to pay attention to the flow of argument. What's the speaker's intended conclusion? What are the reasons given in support of that conclusion? And how precisely are they supposed to support the conclusion? I'll also ask you whether the reasons given really do support the conclusion. Is the argument valid? In another lecture, we've talked about standard forms of bogus arguments, fallacies. I want you to keep a sharp eye open for those. Without further ado, the first debate. The topic, democracy.
It's becoming clearer every day that democracy is the wave of the future. What we have witnessed is the increasing democratization of the world. The Arab Spring is only one of the more recent signs. Dictatorships are falling, monarchies and hereditary aristocracies and oligarchies are tumbling. There's a scent of freedom in the air, power to the people. That's the stirring cry of human progress. That's the sound of democracy on the march. But don't take my word for it. Here's some hard data from Freedom House, an international organization that conducts research on the topic. Freedom House categorizes countries as either free, partly free, or not free. If you look at their data, you'll see that the percentage of free countries in the world has risen approximately 20% over the last 35 years, and we can project that trend into the future. By 2045, over 60% of all countries will be free. By the turn of the next century, the transition will be complete. Almost every country in the world will be free. We won't have long to wait. Democracy is the wave of the future.
I know we haven't heard from the other side yet, but let's stop things right there. Let's look at the flow of that first argument. I have three questions for you as an observer and a judge in the debate. Question one, what is McFirst's conclusion? Question two, what is the argument he gives for that conclusion? If there are multiple arguments, what are they? How precisely does his reasoning go? And question three, did you notice any fallacies going by? If you want to pause and review, go right ahead. So start with question number one. What is the conclusion of the argument? Here's a good candidate. He said, what we have witnessed is the increasing democratization of the world. Interestingly, there's also another good candidate for the conclusion. Democracy is the wave of the future. In what you just heard, McFirst tended to run those two together, but they're really separate propositions. One proposition is that more and more countries have become democratic. That's a claim about what we're seeing now. The other is the claim that democracy is the wave of the future, that such a trend will continue into the future. The first proposition is the one he represented with his initial chart. The second proposition is the one he put forward by talking of extending the line. So let's examine the first conclusion. We are witnessing the increasing democratization of the world. What support does he give for that conclusion? What reasons does he give for us to believe it? At the beginning, he just gave us a few vague images. Dictatorships are falling. Monarchies and hereditary aristocracies are tumbling. But then he gave us what he said is hard data. According to Freedom House, free countries, we assume he means democracies, have increased by 20% over the last 35 years. Well, that's not a bad argument. at least if we can trust the data, if we can trust the source, that does make it look like we've seen an increase in democratization. But that was only one conclusion offered in the argument. The other was, democracy is the wave of the future. He represented that by extending the lines into the future. Do we have any additional argument that the observed trend will continue? He says we can project that into the future. If we do, we get his optimistic estimates for worldwide democracy in 2045 and the turn of the next century. Do we really have any further reason to believe that? It doesn't look like it. What about fallacies? Did McFirst use any fallacious sleights of hand? If you said appeal to emotion, I think you're right. It's evident in the emotional language he used. A scent of freedom in the air. Power to the people. The stirring cry of human decency. The sound of democracy on the march. Those just amount to emotional cheerleading for democracy. We may agree that democracy is a wonderful thing, but that doesn't really advance McFirst's conclusion that it's becoming more widespread. Those phrases are just designed to push your emotional buttons. That's just our first bit of debate, and I've already talked longer than Mr. McFirst has. Let's hear what Ms. O'Second has to say in response. In a minute, I'll again be asking you question number one, what conclusion or conclusions are at stake? Question two, what argument or arguments are given? How does the reasoning go? How good are those arguments? And question three, have any fallacies been committed?
I'll give you one thing, Mr. McFirst. We would certainly all like to think that democracy is the wave of the future, but wanting doesn't make it so. I'm afraid I have to challenge your oh-so-rosy and optimistic conclusions. The Arab Spring stirred great hopes in freedom-loving people. But that's because we chose to interpret the Arab Spring in a very particular way. We viewed it as something like an American revolution in the Middle East, down with the dictator, up with human rights and constitutional democracy. I invite you to look at that event more carefully. There were many players in the events of the Arab Spring, and they weren't all advocates of democracy, at least not democracy in the sense we think of it. Whether what we've seen is really a triumph for democracy is something we can't know yet. It is just as likely that the result of those events will not be democracy, but theocracy, governmental control by a religious elite. It is just as likely that the result will not be human rights for everybody, but expanded rights for a few, at the cost of rights for others. It is also very possible that governments set up as a result of those events will be flimsy and fragile, ripe for the takeover by a military junta, or I'm sorry to say, by another dictator. Your one piece of real data, McFirst, is based on a report card published by Freedom House. Much as it claims to be an international organization unaffiliated with any government, surely it's significant that Freedom House is based in Washington, D.C. How do we know it's not just a front for the United States government or for the CIA? Let me finally take issue with your future projections. If we do accept the Freedom House data, there is no particular reason to think we can extend your blue line into the future. Let me give you an analogy. In 1971, Gillette introduced the twin razor blade. In 1998, they introduced the first triple-blade razor, the Mach 3. Four blade razors appeared between 1998 and 2005 when a five-blade razor was introduced. Extend that history in a line like my opponent wants to do, and we'll be seeing hundreds of blades on our razors by 2050. Ridiculous. But that's just like your future projections for democracy. A democracy worldwide, you wish.
Ah, now things are getting a little heated. Let's go to our questions. Well, what were the conclusions? What's the flow of argument, the pattern of reasoning offered? Is her argument valid? Just how good is it? And did you notice any fallacies going by? Press rewind if you want to hear the argument again. Press pause if you want to think about it a minute. Then come back. What is Ms. Osecant's conclusion? That her opponent's wrong, of course. We said that McFirst really had two claims. One, that democracy is increasing in the world, and two, that it's the wave of the future. Which of those was Ms. Osecant attacking? If you said both, you're right. Part of her response was directed at his claim that we've seen democracy increasing. The other part of her response was directed at the claim that democracy is the wave of the future. But she used, importantly, different arguments in those two parts. Try to reconstruct in your mind her argument against the claim that democracy is increasing. Now try to reconstruct what her argument was against the future projection of democracy as the wave of the future. What precisely were those arguments? Take the claim that democracy is increasing. Here, Ms. Osecant really had two arguments. The Arab Spring had been mentioned as a recent sign of increased democratization. Ms. Osecant attempts to throw skeptical cold water on that example. Her argument is that we can't know what we've seen until we see how it eventually pans out. She says, whether what we've seen is really a triumph for democracy is something we can't know yet. Maybe it'll end up in a theocracy, she suggests, in a military junta, or in another dictator. That's a fairly direct challenge to McFirst's claim. Maybe we aren't really seeing an increase in democratization. Maybe we're reading more into it than we really have reason to hope for. How good is that argument? You'll note that it doesn't really prove that McFirst is wrong. It doesn't show that the Arab Spring will result in some non-democratic future. It attacks not so much the claim as McFirst's confidence in it. Maybe we can't yet tell. That's one argument against the democracy is increasing claim, an attack on its certainty. In a second argument, Ms. Osecant attempts to knock down the one data-driven argument that McFirst gives. McFirst relied on Freedom House data. Ms. Osecant attempts to undercut his argument by impugning that source. Remember? Surely it's significant that Freedom House is based in Washington, D.C. How do we know it's not just a front for the United States government or for the CIA? That argument doesn't show that the data is wrong. Like the first argument, its goal is to raise doubts. Osecant's arguments, then, are skeptical arguments, intended to raise doubts about the evaluations we tend to make of the Arab Spring, intended to raise doubts about the reliability of Freedom House data. What about her challenge to McFirst's second claim, that democracy is the wave of the future? She attacks that claim even if the first goes through. She says, even if we do accept the Freedom House data, there's no particular reason to think we can extend your blue line into the future. At that point, she uses an argument from analogy, the multiple blade razor analogy. Twin blade razors in 1971, three blades in 1998, four blades by 2005. Extend a linear projection of that history, she says, and we'll see razors with hundreds of blades by 2050. Ridiculous, she says. Just like linear projections for future democratization. How strong an argument by analogy is depends on how strong the analogy is. What's your take on that in this case? I think this particular analogy is probably not particularly good here. At best, it just shows that sometimes we can't project current trends into the future. That doesn't give us any particular reason to believe that this is one of those times. All in all, then, how strong do you think Osecant's response was? If she was out to refute McFirst, I'm afraid she didn't fully succeed. She certainly didn't show his claims to be false. If she was out to raise a few doubts about his confidence, or ours, well, maybe she did succeed at that. What about fallacies? You probably saw at least one. I think there are actually a couple in here, entwined. Both have to do with her attack on Freedom House. McFirst used data from Freedom House. Osecant seems to think we shouldn't accept or rely on that data. Why not? She says, it is surely significant that Freedom House is located in Washington, D.C. That sounds like the ad hominem fallacy. She's implying some kind of underhanded or ulterior motive, an implication that Freedom House is just pushing U.S. policy, perhaps. She's poisoning the well. She adds to that fallacy with an appeal to ignorance. She doesn't really give us any solid reason to think Freedom House should be discredited. She relies instead on leading questions. How do we know it's not just a front for the United States government? How do we know it's not just a front for the CIA? Appeal to ignorance. It's Mr. McFirst's turn again. Let's see how he responds. Here again, I want you to try to identify major conclusions. I want you to identify and evaluate patterns of reasoning and keep an eye out for fallacies.
Well, I guess even democracy has some enemies. It's hard to believe in this day and age that anyone could think that a theocracy or a benevolent dictatorship was preferable to our tradition of individual rights and majority rule. But that seems to be what my opponent is arguing for. I'm the first to admit that the majority isn't always right. That would be the fallacy of appeal to the majority, after all. Allow me to quote a great statesman, Winston Churchill. Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried. When the impact of a policy is spread across the entire population, surely the whole population has a right to decide on that policy. It's not a single individual that has that right. It's not a hereditary aristocracy. It's not a chosen few. It's the people who have the right to decide policy that will govern the people. That's democracy. That's the form of government that is on the rise, however much my opponent may dislike it.
Okay, I'm going to stop the debate right there. That was a really poor response, Mr. McFirst. You disappoint me. You're using rhetorical tricks right out of Schopenhauer's List. The basic problem is this. McFirst isn't arguing against Osecant's real position. Rather than taking on the position that's really on the floor, he's picked an easier position to argue against. By the same token, an easier position to argue for. What McFirst just gave us was almost entirely a straw man argument. At the beginning, you remember, McFirst was arguing that worldwide adoption of democracy was on the rise and would continue. Ms. Osecant challenged his reasons for believing that. This time around, McFirst has charged her with arguing that democracy is not a good thing, that theocracy or benevolent dictatorship would be better. Press replay and you'll find that she never said anything like that. He's attacking a position she never held. He's attacking a straw man, or in this case, maybe a straw woman. By the same token, McFirst is giving himself an easier position to argue for. Not that democracy is historically on the rise, that we can predict that it'll spread, but just that it's a good thing, or as Churchill said, the worst except for all those other forms of government. If we're looking for fallacies, that quote from Churchill might also count as an emotion-loaded appeal to authority. You're using rhetoric rather than appealing to rationality, McFirst. Let's go back and see if you can present a better argument.
Okay, let me try again. Ms. Osecant challenged my first conclusion by casting aspersions on the data from Freedom House. Most of her attack was a fallacious appeal to ignorance. Let me address that directly by reducing some of the ignorance. Freedom House is not an agency of any government. I admit that American foreign policy is a focus and that the organization is based in the United States. Why shouldn't it be? Founded in 1941, it is an advocacy group for political liberty and human rights worldwide. In the 1940s, its target was fascism. In the 50s, communism was its target. Although it took a strong stand against McCarthyism at home. The data I offered comes from an annual survey called Freedom in the World, published each year since 1972. It uses a strategy devised by leading social scientists based on the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights in order to objectively rate every country in the world on indicators for both political rights and civil liberties. Political indicators include electoral process, political pluralism, and lack of corruption. Indicators for civil liberties include freedom of expression and belief, rights of free association, and the rule of law. That's the data that says that the proportion of free countries in the world has risen 20% in the last 35 years. That's the data that says we're witnessing an increase in democracy. As to my second claim, that we can extend that data line into the future, I guess I have to admit that one can't always project current trends directly. But you'll note that Ms. O'Second didn't suggest any forces that might buck that trend. She didn't give any reason to think that the forces that have been driving democratic progress over the last 35 years won't continue. That's my point.
That's a lot better, Mr. McFirst. Now you're focusing on the real points of disagreement, not some made up for a rhetorical effect. You've backed up your data claim for your first conclusion that we've been witnessing increasing democratization worldwide. We might still want to look at the details, but you've certainly countered the appeal to ignorance with real information. I notice that you've also backpedaled on your second conclusion a bit. Now you've replaced your initial confident claim that the trend will continue with a more modest claim that there's no reason to think it won't. I don't take that as a mark of rhetorical weakness. I take that as a mark of rational strength. Good for you, Mr. McFirst. Let's see how Ms. O'Second responds.
I'm glad that my opponent has seen the light. I am as much an advocate of democracy as he is. Democracy, real democracy, is important. Important things take real work, so democracy is going to take real work. That's why we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that it's easier or more inevitable than it is. Is democracy the wave of the future? That won't be true, I think, unless we work to make it so. We have been raised in a tradition of individual rights that goes back to the American Revolution, including rights to religious freedom. Because of our background, it's hard for us to think of our form of democracy as anything other than the natural form of self-governance. But you have to remember that we got here only by a very specific historical path. Our history was one of Protestant Reformation long before the American Revolution and of colonies physically separating from the mother country. It's not clear that our democracy would have formed without those precedents. It's not clear that it's exportable without such a history. Consider the French Revolution. That too announced the rights of man. But it had a very different outcome. An outcome that led directly to Emperor Napoleon. Other societies don't have the same historical precedents that we did. Democracy with religious freedom as a major component may not come so easily to them. And even when democracy does come in other societies, it may come in a different form. Other societies may become more democratic without adopting a form that ultimately looks very much like our system at all. That's my point.
This may be a little more subtle and a little harder. We want to know, what's the conclusion? What's the intended flow of argument? How solid is the reasoning? And are there any fallacies involved? Did you notice that she began with an Aristotelian syllogism? Right here. Democracy, real democracy, is important. Important things take real work. So democracy is going to take real work. Aristotle would be pleased. With that reasoning, she gives her initial challenge a different spin than we saw before. She argued earlier that O'First's projection into the future was unjustified. Here she says that we shouldn't assume the inevitability of democracy because democratization is going to take real work. What happens in the rest of the argument? O'Second uses a thumbnail sketch of the American Revolution as the backdrop for another little argument. It starts from the claim that our democracy wouldn't have the form it does without particular aspects of its historical background. The Protestant Reformation, for example, and our existence as colonies. From that, she draws the inference that we should therefore not expect other paths to democracy in other cultures to look like ours. We shouldn't expect the outcome to be the same. How good is that reasoning? Interesting, but I think we have to say it's suggestive rather than a solid proof. She doesn't prove that our institutions demanded those particular historical precedents, nor does she prove that other cultures with other histories couldn't reach the same outcome. If you look at her language carefully, she seems to recognize that this line of thought is merely suggestive. She doesn't really say that our democracy wouldn't have formed without the historical precedents she names. She says it's not clear that it would have. She doesn't say democracy is bound to come in different forms. She said it may. What Osecon has given us in the whole course of the debate, then, are some skeptical doubts and some suggestive counter-suggestions. In urging us not to immediately accept her opponent's stirring forecast of a predictable rise in democratization worldwide, that may be enough. An interesting debate. Not up to the standards of Lincoln and Douglas, perhaps, but a good exercise for analysis. What happened in that other debate? A major topic there was the expansion of slavery into the territories, and by implication, slavery in general. Douglas was clearly on one side. He said, "I believe this government was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever. And I'm in favor of confining citizenship to white men, men of European birth and descent, instead of conferring it upon Negroes, Indians, and other inferior races." There were shouts of encouragement from the audience. Lincoln's position? Quote, "There's no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." But at other stops on the debate trail, he says things that are far less inspiring. He says, "I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, nor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people." Douglas accused Lincoln of contradicting himself. Lincoln accused Douglas of twisting language so as to make a horse chestnut into a chestnut horse. Debates. Next time, we'll look at another place that rhetoric and fallacies appear, the realm of advertising. If there's one thing we're all exposed to, it's advertisements. The number of 30-second television commercials seen by the average American child in a year has been estimated at 20,000. At that rate, the average American sees 2 million television commercials in a lifetime. At billboards, newspapers, magazines, mailed flyers, phone solicitations, online advertising, and in-store signage, advertising is ubiquitous. The advertiser's job is to get you to buy something or to vote for someone. Getting you to reason logically isn't part of the job description. If they can sell you something without having you think logically, or by making you think illogically, or not think at all, that's all in a day's work. Philosophers often analyze advertising in terms of logical fallacies. You know a number of those already: ad hominem, false alternative, post hoc ergo propter hoc, appeal to ignorance, hasty generalization. In this lecture, I'll take a different tack. When it comes to advertising, it's often more effective to think in terms of psychological categories. Advertisers use every psychological strategy available. Outwitting the advertiser demands a philosophically critical attitude, attuned both to logic and to a range of psychological techniques. I'm going to divide those psychological techniques into two rough categories. The first is a category that relies not on information, not on content, but merely on pushing your buttons. The second category does rely on content and does use information, but that information is used in misleadingly persuasive ways. Let me start with a particular kind of button pushing that I'll call attractiveness attracts. It's been estimated that 25% of men begin balding by age 30, 2/3 by age 60. All in all, 35 million American men are losing their hair. That's about half. Outside of commercials for baldness remedies, how many bald men do you see as spokesmen on television commercials? The Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index indicates that 63% of Americans are either overweight or obese. Outside of weight loss commercials, how many overweight and obese people do you see as spokespeople on television commercials? That's right. The people in television commercials are a strange breed, a different species. They're far more attractive than the average person next door. Why do ads use good-looking people? Because attractiveness attracts. Regardless of the quality of what's being sold, regardless of even what product is being sold, you can bet that an attractive person will be used to sell it. It's your non-rational psychology, rather than your logical rationality, that's being appealed to. Attractiveness is ubiquitous in advertising, and I don't think we can expect that to change. I'm not arguing that advertisers should be forced to pick spokespeople at random, overweight, bald, and all. Of course not. The point's just that to process advertising rationally, we have to be aware of and have to compensate for the fact that attractiveness attracts. In judging whether to buy what a commercial wants us to buy or to vote how a commercial wants us to vote, we need to filter out that aspect of persuasion that relies merely on an irrelevant attractiveness factor. But of course, it's not just the people in advertisements that are at their attractive best. The settings are also pristine. Beer is shown on gorgeous beaches that somehow have no crowds. People in ads speak to you from kitchens that are as clean and spacious as stage sets. That's because they are stage sets. So commercials feature unrealistically attractive people in unrealistically attractive locations. We shouldn't be surprised that they picture the product in the most attractive way as well. Car ads feature single cars gliding through isolated and beautiful surroundings. They're photographed from helicopters, without the sound of helicopters, as they smoothly curve mountain roads, or as they execute a choreographed pirouette on what looks like an enormous airstrip. Never another car in sight. Who wants to buy a car that gets stuck in traffic jams? Guess what? All cars get stuck in traffic jams. I've seen wonderful displays in which people put images from advertisements for fast food next to the most attractive photographs they were able to make of the same item as actually purchased. Advertising images of tidy, well-stuffed tacos next to the peculiarly flat or greasy or partially filled shells you've just paid for. Advertising images of tall, super burgers with crisp lettuce, red tomatoes, and attractively melted cheese next to the real sandwich, a little squished and lopsided, the one that actually comes over the counter. Those tomatoes just don't seem to look the same. I invite you to duplicate the experiment yourself next time you go to a fast food restaurant. Look at the image pictured on the overhead menu. Hold up what you purchase and see how representative that image is of what you just bought. In 1970, the Federal Trade Commission settled a complaint against Campbell's Soup, who apparently put marbles in the bottom of the bowl to push the vegetables to the top. Each year, fast food and casual dining chains spend more than $4 billion on television advertising, and it's on the rise. It's not surprising that there's a small industry of specialists working to make food look good in the ads. But what you see may not always be what you think you see. Ice cream melts under the photographic lights, so lard has been used instead. The ice in cold drinks may actually be acrylic. Glue has been used to keep spaghetti on the forks. Off-camera hypodermics to make the sauce drip. Machines under the table to give that appealing waft of steam. All because attractiveness attracts. So here's a thought experiment for you. What would an ad look like that didn't rely on an attractiveness factor? A A car ad would show a photograph of the car in a normal environment under normal lighting, with perhaps facts on gas mileage and repair record. A food ad would show a photograph of the hamburger precisely as delivered. Neither of those sounds very attractive, but that's just the point. What you're imagining right now is, in fact, precisely what you're buying. All of the attractiveness you see in commercials above and beyond that isn't appealing to your logic or your rationality. It's just manipulating you psychologically. What I've been emphasizing is the ubiquitous use of attractiveness in advertising. But let me add an exception that proves the rule point as well. Precisely because attractiveness attracts is the standard strategy, some advertising campaigns catch your attention by deliberately flaunting that strategy. Frank Perdue was a bald and scrawny man who reminded people of the chickens he was selling. His very unattractiveness was used to convey sincerity and quality concern. And it worked. Dave Thomas, the man who founded Wendy's, was bashful, soft-spoken, and on the plump side. The fact that he broke the stereotype for attractive spokespeople lent an air of homey honesty to Wendy's commercials. That, I guess, is reverse psychology in terms of attractiveness in advertising. But it's still mere image. The hamburger pictured in the ad may still have only a remote resemblance to what they hand you over the counter. Another form of button pushing is appeal to prestige. European associations tend to carry that prestige. Perrier water and Grey Poupon mustard from France, for example. Or Haagen-Dazs ice cream from... Where exactly is Haagen-Dazs from? Denmark, maybe? Somewhere in Scandinavia? Actually, Haagen-Dazs was founded in the Bronx in 1960 by Polish immigrants Ruben and Rose Mattis. The name Haagen-Dazs was made up to look European to American eyes. Neither a double A with an initial umlaut nor a combination ZS at the end are part of any Scandinavian language. Dutch has a double A but no umlaut. I'm told that the only European language with a ZS is Hungarian. This is called foreign branding in the marketing industry. Haagen-Dazs is an entirely fictional piece of foreign branding. Indeed, early packaging also included an outline map of Denmark on the label, despite lack of any real association with Denmark. A button-pushing, fallacious appeal to prestige. Fake foreign branding actually ended up in a legal case. There was another foreign-sounding ice cream called Frusengladje. If you leave the accent off that final E, that name actually means something. Frusenglasje means frozen delight in Swedish. But despite the fact that the package carried three lines of Swedish, Frusenglasje was never sold in Sweden. It was produced, packed by an American company, and distributed entirely within the United States. In 1980, the non-Danish Haagen-Dazs sued the non-Swedish Frusenglasje for stealing their trade dress, the general look of a product, which is protected under American law. They lost. The court said there was little chance of confusion between the two. Haagen-Dazs had also claimed that Frusenglasje was illegitimately labeling their product as if it were Swedish. The court noted that Haagen-Dazs had equally dirty hands. Attractiveness attracts works not only for products, but for politics. In filming a political ad, you want your candidate to look presidential. You want your candidate seen with a dramatic lighting, a prestigious podium in front, and an American flag in the background. But of course, your candidate is running against someone else. The flip side of attractiveness attracts is that unattractiveness detracts. Political advertisements, television, internet, newspaper, and mass distribution flyers standardly seek out the least attractive image of their opponent that they can find. If you can find an image of your opponent looking annoyed or bewildered or shaking hands with Hitler, you'll use it. You notice that I just switched to speaking of you as the advertiser. And that's not a bad strategy for outwitting the advertiser. You can imagine what you would do if you were just out to push buttons, regardless of content. Because you can imagine what you would do on the sending end, you'll know it when you see it on the receiving end. Appeal to emotion is a classic fallacy. One of the places it shows up in is in political advertising. There, the emotions most often exploited are political pride and fear. If you're filming a political commercial, it'd be great to have an American flag rippling in the breeze. If you pan across amber waves of grain with America the Beautiful rising on the soundtrack, all the better. You note that I haven't said anything about who your candidate is or what your candidate stands for. I've just told you to use emotionally charged patriotic images. Next time you see those, whoever the candidate and whatever the message, remember that what you're seeing is a fallacious appeal to emotion. The other emotion exploited in political advertising is fear. A classic example is the television commercial used by Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater in 1964. It opens with a little girl happily counting petals on a daisy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 6, 8. The count then starts in the other direction by a male voiceover.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Culminating in the flash of a nuclear explosion. Johnson then comes on in voiceover.
To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark, we must either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
The implication is that Johnson's opponent, Barry Goldwater of Arizona, is a reckless man ready to pull the nuclear trigger. We've talked about the fallacy of false alternative, and this is another example, but it's also clearly an appeal to emotion, and that emotion is fear. Fear of what will happen if you elect the other guy has probably been used in every political campaign since George Washington. It's a good bet it'll be used in the next one. The fear might be of a terrorist attack, of overcompetition by China, of what will happen if we don't have mandated health insurance, of what will happen if we do, of future generations burdened by our debt, or a future without Social Security. All of those represent issues that should be rationally considered in a political decision, that should be addressed with relevant evidence and careful argument in political debate. The problem is that they almost never are. They're used as hair triggers for fear instead. One way of sensitizing oneself to fallacious advertising is to learn the standard categories. Appeal to emotion is one of those, as is appeal to prestige. But you don't have to know the names. Here's a simple philosophical tool for detecting the kinds of fallacies we've been talking about. Take any advertisement. Read it or listen to it or watch it with care, and then sit down with a piece of paper and write at the top, the reasons given for buying the product were, and list them, 1, 2, 3. Also write, the reasons given for buying this product rather than a competitor were, list those one by one. A rational decision is one based on reasons. Rational means reasonable. And reasonable demands reasons. If you're going to do one thing rather than another, or buy one brand rather than another, or vote for one candidate rather than another, any rational decision is going to be based on reasons. So sit down with any advertisement and try to cash it out in terms of reasons. The reasons given for buying the product were. If the advertisement is relying merely on an attractive image, it may turn out you can find no reasons to list at all. Sometimes you can list reasons, but once examined, it becomes clear that they aren't very good reasons, like, it sounds Swedish. Once you try to cash out standard commercials in terms of reasons, it becomes pretty clear how far from rational their appeal often is. Here's another fallacy common in advertising, the appeal to dubious authority. An instantly recognizable celebrity touts the virtues of the product, recommends it, or says that they use it. What makes an appeal to dubious authority is that you're given no reason to believe that the celebrity knows what they're talking about. Here are some examples. Tiger Woods did a series of commercials touting Buicks. Tiger's a great golfer. He's had some serious marital problems, but we've got no reason to believe he knows much about cars. Johnny Depp does Mont Blanc watches. Good-looking guy, great fun as an actor, but I'm not sure he's an authority on watches. Most of the advertisements we've talked about so far rely on psychological manipulation rather than on claims or statements of fact. Some commercials do make claims, however, either explicitly or by implication. Aren't there laws against false advertising? Indeed, there are. The core piece of federal legislation is the Lanham Act, which prohibits any commercial advertising or promotion that misrepresents the nature, characteristics, qualities, or geographic origin of goods, services, or commercial activities. The Federal Trade Commission is empowered to enforce regulations against unfair and deceptive practices in commerce. The FTC has acted against false and misleading advertising, against marbles in the bottom of the bowl, for example, and against an ad campaign by the California Milk Producers Advisory Board that touted, "Everybody needs milk." Of course, that's not true. Milk is the last thing that the lactose intolerant need. The FTC acted against Amoco Oil for claiming that crystal clear Amoco Ultimate was better for your car and better for the environment because it was clear. Amoco had no evidence to back up those claims. But the result of such action rarely goes beyond an order to pull the ads or to demand corrective advertising. No advertising executive is doing hard time for false advertising. The law also allows consumers and rival companies to pursue civil action. The suit must prove a false statement of fact that could be expected to deceive, must prove that it was likely to affect purchasing decisions, and that the plaintiff suffered injury of some kind. Short of a class action case, that kind of litigation is a tall and expensive order for any consumer. The way most false advertising appears in court is in civil suits by one company against another, like Häagen-Dazs versus Frusenglasche, for example. And of course, the legal restrictions we're talking about extend only to commercial advertising. Political advertising isn't included. You don't need to say something false in order to get someone to believe something false. One way of misleading someone is to tell them the truth, but be careful not to tell them the whole truth. Consider just a few of the phrases that tend to show up in advertising. None proven more effective. That claim's true even if all competing brands have been shown to be equally effective. Indeed, none proven more effective is true if none were proven effective at all. Faster acting, or more effective, or longer lasting than the leading brand. It's not always clear what the leading brand is. It might be true that my product is faster acting than the leading brand, and still be true that it's slower acting than any of the other contenders. Recommended by doctors. It doesn't say recommended by all doctors, or even recommended by most doctors. It just says recommended by doctors. It'd be hard to find a pharmaceutical that wasn't recommended by some doctors. It may be literally true, then, that a product is recommended by doctors, but any implication of general medical consensus is a false implication. You get the idea. If the advertiser can speak a limited truth and get you to make false inferences, he's within the letter of the law and yet still doing a great job of deception. Everything he says may be literally true. What you are led to believe may be false nonetheless. More recently, recommended by doctors has given way to a similar implication carried by something that isn't even a statement. Ask your doctor whether Bonitranq might be right for you. Here's a final category of advertising tricks, the magic word. There are a whole set of magic words that reappear in advertising. Some may not mean what you think they mean. Some may not mean much of anything at all. Consider, for example, foods labeled low fat, reduced fat, light, 98% fat-free, or simply fat-free, low calorie, reduced calorie, lower sodium, light. All of that sounds great, but what do those words mean? When you check the Food and Drug Administration guidelines, some of those terms carry absolute standards. A main dish counts as low fat if it contains less than 3% fat and not more than 30% of its calories come from fat. Some of those terms are relative terms instead. A potato chip can boast of reduced sodium if it has at least 25% less sodium than your standard run-of-the-mill potato chip. The standard's higher for light. You need 50% fewer calories than the standard can of beer to qualify as a light beer. A big proviso for standards like that is that they often have no legal teeth. They're merely non-binding industry recommendations. There's also another problem here. If a product is labeled low fat, that means it contains a certain percentage of fat. It doesn't mean it won't make you fat. A product can be labeled low fat despite the fact that it's packed with calories, sugar, carbohydrates, and salt. Indeed, Twizzlers candy boasts of being a low-fat food. They don't mean it'll keep you low fat. So here again we have selective mention. It may be true that a product has low fat, but that should make you wonder about the other aspects that might be important. Calories, carbohydrates, and salt, for example. The label that says low salt may speak the truth, but what it labels may still be unhealthy in other ways. There's no complete list of magic words to watch out for. Advertisers can be counted on to borrow or invent magic words faster than they can be specified in law or in non-binding industry recommendations. It took the USDA 10 years to settle on a definition for organic. Many of the magic words sound good, but when you stop to ask yourself what they mean, it's not clear that they mean much of anything at all. New, improved, new and improved, original, vitamin enriched, with 6 antioxidants, healthy, economy sized, heart healthy, nutritious, better tasting, longer lasting, home style, all natural, and my favorite, as seen on TV. We certainly haven't exhausted the topic of fallacious advertising. That topic is big enough for a course of its own. What I've tried to do is to give you a feel for 2-4 major categories of fallacious advertising. One thing to look out for is everything that isn't information, everything that's just out to push your buttons. The other thing to look out for is the misleading use of any information that does appear. To think about what that information really means and what information you're not being given. Now it's your turn. We're going to end by giving you 2 clips for analysis. These aren't real ads, but they'll work as samples, and you can go on to dissect the real ads on your own. In each case, listen to the ad, pause the tape, and think about it for a minute. I want you to name what's wrong or suspicious about each ad. You could do this in terms of categories, standard categories like appeal to authority, for example, but it'll do just as well to ask just 3 questions. What psychological buttons are being pushed? What is the precise claim that's being made? And what relevant information may have been left out? If you can do that in each case, you're well on your way to outwitting the advertiser.
You're alone upstairs in the dark. You hear a window break downstairs and the phone being ripped from the wall. Someone is starting up the stairs. They are coming closer to your bedroom door. Closer. Closer. You can see the doorknob turn. Don't you wish you had a gun? Gun control? Tell them no on Proposition 12.
What's happening in that ad? If you said they were pushing emotional buttons, you're right. That's a classic appeal to fear. Gun control is a complicated topic, with both facts and important principles at issue. Principles about the right to self-protection, for example, but also statistics on the likelihood of shooting friends or family rather than an intruder. It's a tough issue, worthy of careful and detailed rational discussion, deliberation, and debate. Did the ad address any of that? No. It merely stimulated fear. It dealt with a complex and controversial social issue merely by manipulating your emotions. Okay, we have time for one more. Let's see if you can name the main fallacy committed in this commercial and at least two other points. Let's see if you can outwit the advertiser.
Hard day at the lab? Do what I do. Energize with ErgoSip. Physicians will tell you that fatigue is a feeling of weariness, tiredness, or lack of energy. Physicists will tell you that energy is the ability to do work. Energy. That's what energy drinks are made for. But did you know that most other energy drinks are mostly water? That's right, water. ErgoSip, made with the finest ingredients. And the taste? Well, there's nothing quite like it. Had a hard day at the lab? Do what I do. Reach for a tall, cold can of ErgoSip.
Okay, what about that one? Some of the finer points. Most other energy drinks are mostly water. That's true enough. The major ingredient in all energy drinks is water. The implication is that ErgoSip is somehow different. But of course, the ad never said that. Made of the finest ingredients. What does that mean? And the taste, well, there's nothing quite like it. That's true for just about everything. No real information there. The major fallacy here, however, is appeal to dubious authority. It actually appears in two different ways. There's an appeal to the authority of both physicists and physicians. Physicians will tell you that fatigue is a feeling of weariness, tiredness, or lack of energy. Physicists will tell you that energy is the ability to do work. Those are really just definitions in the fields, of course. They aren't talking about ErgoSip. Appeal to dubious authority is built into the whole setup. Test tubes, lab coat, blackboard full of equations. Who is this person? What lab? This has appeal to dubious authority written all over it. In order to outwit the advertiser, you have to see through attractiveness attracts, appeal to prestige, appeal to emotion, appeal to dubious authority, misleading half-truths, and magic words. Learn to see through the spin. Next time we'll talk about spin again, not in advertising, but in putting a spin on statistics. Statistics are an important form of information. That's why proponents on any side of an issue will try to use statistics, even abuse statistics, in order to win arguments. But here's an informal statistic on statistics. Most people are far more critical of statistics offered for a view they don't support than they are of statistics offered for a view they agree with. I'd like to change that a bit. In this lecture, I'll be using lots of examples. They'll come from many sides of many issues. What I'd like is for us all to be a bit more critical of statistics on all sides of an issue, our own included. Let me give you a couple of statistics. I don't want you to think about them in terms of whether they support your view or not. I want you to think about them in more critical terms than that. I want you to think about them critically as statistics. Statistic number one can be easily put in a single sentence. Every year since 1950, twice as many American children have been killed with guns. Statistic two is trickier. This one's in the form of a graph for the years between 1960 and 1970. One line on the graph represents the murder rate between those years, the number of homicides per 100,000 population. The other line represents the number of people executed for murder each year. What the graph shows is that as the number of executions between 1960 and 1970 steadily falls, the number of homicides steadily rises. People love statistics, and well they should. Statistics give us the straight facts. They give us those facts in numbers and graphs that are easy to understand. I want to start by making it clear that I think statistics are great. We want the straight facts, inflexible and uncompromising,